The following is an encore presentation of the World Vision Report.
This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. On today's show, some women in Ghana use creams to lighten their skin. Now they're finding that's as harmful to their health as tanning. Plus, we go to Mexico, the birthplace of chocolate, to taste a traditional hot drink called chocolate atole.
Here we have in front of us have cacao, cinnamon, almonds, and sugar. This is the flavor I learned from my grandma.
And remembering Monique, a young midwife in Mali who dedicated her life to her patients.
I think the other women at first questioned, who is this young woman who has such power? But then they saw how skilled she was, and they saw how much she deeply cared for their health and their babies.
Around the world with the World Vision Report. First, this news. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. Many of us spent time this summer trying to get a tan. That's in spite of the cancer risk. In India and Africa, people with dark skin sometimes do just the opposite. They try to make their skin lighter. That's also a health risk. From Accra, Ghana, Michelle Betts looks at the cost of lightening your skin.
Here in one of Accra's sprawling markets, where the smell of dried fish permeates everything, you don't have to walk far before you spot a vendor selling products to lighten skin.
We have Numa, this one.
We have a product called Numa. You spread it on your body. We have another product called Fair White.
That's Rosemary Tetty. She's showing me just some of the bleaching creams available in her shop.
Maxitone Life, you want to tone the body.
And we have Maxitone. They're all bleaching lotions and creams.
All these products are marketed to produce what's known here as cocoa skin, a term that means light skin. Bleaching has been going on in Ghana for decades. Some blame the legacy of colonialism and the prostitutes who started the practice because they wanted to attract whites. But as time went on, bleaching became more common. Fair skin became synonymous with beauty. No one knows exactly how many women bleach, but the practice is widespread. Further into the market, I chat with some women selling dry goods. Most of them, at some time or another, have bleached their skin, some since they were teenagers. Gifty Afreya is one of them. She says she's been using bleaching creams for more than 30 years.
We use it to attract.
We use it to become attractive. That's the main reason.
Sometimes
I bleach when I see my face is becoming too black, so I will still be attractive.
Vic Odako leaves her stall to join us. She wants to be like me, she tells me. Fair, white. And that, Vic says, is why she bleached for some 30 years. But she adds, it doesn't always work. She says she stopped bleaching because she ended up with multicolored blotches on her face, the result of exposing bleached skin to the sun. It's a permanent side effect, but it's far from the worst one. Dr. Herbert Addo is a dermatologist in Accra. He sees firsthand the devastating effects of bleaching. Particularly damaging, Addo says, are creams containing steroids, which are illegal here, but still widely available.
With the corticosteroids, the effect of prolonged use appear. This comes in the form of thinning of the skin, so opportunistic infections appear.
The other common bleaching chemical is something called hydroquinone, which strips away the skin's pigmentation. Both the steroids and hydroquinone leave the skin more vulnerable to infections and UV rays.
If you go on bleaching long enough, you convert your dark skin to a Caucasian type of skin, and the prolonged sunlight exposure could make you susceptible to carcinoma like in anybody else in the sun, heavily sunny areas.
Dr. Addo recounts the story of an educated woman in her 40s who'd been bleaching with hydroquinone since her teens.
She just started developing ulcer on the side of the neck, and this was not healing. We went ahead and biopsied it.
The biopsy showed the woman had cancer.
Within 2 years, she died with metastasis.
So bleaching can actually kill you?
Oh, it can.
Dr. Addo says as long as popular figures like sports stars and singers lighten their skin, it will be difficult to stop the practice.
Unless those in the higher class start avoiding this practice, to be difficult to educate those in the lower class.
Back at the market, I passed one woman who was curious about my microphone.
What are you doing?
I'm doing a story on bleaching.
You'll soon be there.
Yeah.
So you have medicine for it.
Huh?
You have medicine for it.
The woman asked me if I had medicine. She was looking for a cure for her discolored face. But not everyone thinks whiter is better. Joyce was selling hair extensions, hair creams, and wigs. I was sure she'd be selling bleaching creams as well. I was wrong.
I'm not interested in bleaching. Because I'm black. So I don't want to be white. Because I'm not a white lady. So I don't want to be white.
But for the foreseeable future, it seems that few women will share Joyce's attitude. For the World Vision Report, I'm Michelle Betts in Accra, Ghana.
Khong Nai is called the Ray Charles of Cambodia. He's blind, but he doesn't play the piano. He plays the chapai. That's a traditional Cambodian instrument, a bit like a banjo. Khong Nai is the country's only living chapai master. But his musical career almost came to an end during the brutal reign of the Khmer Rouge. From Phnom Penh, here's reporter Jason Struther.
Trash and other debris surround the several dozen dilapidated shacks that make up this squatter village. Khong Nai's home isn't much different. The walls are made of corrugated iron. The roof is held up by thick bamboo branches. Khong sits with his legs folded underneath him on a wooden bed outside of his house. He's 63, blind, and frail. But when he sings, the power of his voice compensates for any other physical weakness. Khong Nai is a living legend. He plays the chapai, a long two-string banjo-like instrument. It's a Cambodian musical tradition that goes back for centuries. His small, dark hands feverishly strum the chapai's strings. His head tilts down, the large pair of black sunglasses he always wears covering his eyes. Khong's shades have earned him the nickname Cambodia's Ray Charles. He says he doesn't mind the comparison.
A lot of people from other countries have called me that. Cambodian chapai music is a lot different from what Ray Charles played, but I'm proud to be compared to such a famous person.
Khong was blinded by smallpox at the age of 4. At 13, his parents bought him his first chapai. 2 years later, he was playing professionally. He explains there is a pattern to chapai's rhythms, but the lyrics are completely improvised. Chapai, Khong says, is all about emotion.
It's like a long movie, but without many actors. Chapai can describe happiness or grief, fighting or even flying through the sky. But the lyrics must connect to the people's feelings.
Khong begrudgingly accepts the title of Cambodia's only living chapai master. If it weren't for the Khmer Rouge, there might be others of his caliber. The Khmer Rouge imprisoned, tortured, and killed intellectuals, artists, and musicians in their effort to build what they saw as a utopian peasant society. They also turned their guns on the disabled. Khong was allowed to live because he could sing propaganda songs. But after 2 years, the regime grew tired of him and sent him into the fields to perform manual labor. That's where he almost starved to death.
I worked so hard during this time that I became sick. I tried to make medicine with roots. I needed sugar to mix with it, but the guards would not give me any. I even began to lose my mind after they executed my brother.
Khong almost met the same fate.
It was either in late 1978 or early 1979. I was told by a Khmer Rouge soldier to be prepared. He said tonight at 3 a.m. I would be transferred. I asked why, and he said that I and other disabled people, as well as some pregnant women who couldn't work, must be moved. I knew at this time I was going to be executed.
But as Khong was sent to the infamous killing fields of Cambodia, the Vietnamese army invaded and drove the Khmer Rouge into the jungles. Kong was saved and in time began playing Chapai again. As Cambodia began to put back together the pieces of its shattered society, Kong rose to fame. Over the years, he's performed for the king and international audiences, and he holds up to 25 concerts a year. Kong says he's most proud of the fact that he's been able to provide for his family, although by most standards, he remains poor. ...27-year-old Paik Sarat practices in a classroom at Cambodia Living Arts, an organization that helps artists like Kong pass on their skills. Paik has been studying with Kong for 5 years. He says that when he was younger, he didn't care much for this music, but after learning about his mentor's life, he realized that Chapai is a part of his heritage worth saving. At first, I was not so interested in learning this music, he says, but Kong Nai has made me love Chapai. These days, there is a new threat that faces Kong and his music. The slum that he has lived in for over a decade is slated to be leveled and its inhabitants relocated to the outskirts of Phnom Penh. Kong says when this happens, he won't be able to travel into the city to perform.
It will really affect my life once they destroy this neighborhood. If the government doesn't help me stay in Phnom Penh, I will lose my career. I will not be able to play music anymore, and I will have to start a new life.
But no matter what his fate is, Kong Nai says he is most concerned about the future of Chapai.
I hope that the young people, blind or not, will keep the Chapai going. It's almost finished. Only I am left. After I die, I'm worried that it will be lost. I hope the next generation will keep our culture in Chapai alive.
For the World Vision Report, I'm Jason Strother in Phnom Penh, Cambodia.
Coming up, music from a Brazilian artist turned politician. Stay with us on the World Vision Report.
I'm Peggy Waymire. Welcome back to the World Vision Report. Gilberto Gil is one of Brazil's most famous musicians. He's been singing and winning awards for decades. Up until last year, he was Brazil's Minister of Culture, a post he held for 5 years. Now Gil's got a new album out, his first since he left his day job. The album was so good it was nominated for a Grammy. Our guide to global music, Tendai Maposa, joins us now from Zimbabwe to talk about Gil's music. Tendai, good to talk to you again.
Yes, thank you, Peggy. It's always good to talk to you, too.
Well, I want to start off with some music from the new album. What do you recommend we listen to get a sense of his music and what he's all about?
Yeah, I think let's start with a song called Others Saw It, which is called Outros Viram in Portuguese, and it's off the album. Rabindranath Tagore preferred a prophecy. Bold enough, he would say that Brazil is going to be a shore, a Florador, into another land, wonderland, yeah, 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 motherland, land of a man reborn on a mat made of sand.
Tendai, how would you describe this song?
Well, it's a classic bossa nova song.
That's Gil and this guitar just by himself. I think it's beautiful.
Now, he went from being a really famous musician straight into politics. It's not often that that happens. But I'm curious as to why he was offered this post as Minister of Culture.
Because I think, like you rightly say, he was a famous musician. So some people blame President Lula's decision to appoint him Minister of Culture as a populist move. But Gil had been involved in politics for a very long time. Back in the 60s, when there was a military government in Brazil, he was actually arrested for being critical of that particular government. And he spent like 3 months in jail and then 6 months under house arrest. And then he joined the Green Party in 1988. He got appointed to different state positions. And then in 2003, President Lula asked him to become the Minister of Culture. So he was not exactly new to politics. He was always on about the environment, about the poor in Brazil, and conservation of the rainforest. So he was always an activist.
So what did he actually accomplish as Minister of Culture? How will he be remembered in that political role?
Well, for starters, he got the government to increase the budget of the Department of Culture by 50%. And he also got more than 650 cultural hotspots established. These are centers with computers, with broadband, and software for free public use.
I'm wondering, because Brazil is also known for its huge favelas or slums, did Gil focus at all on that community when he served in the government?
He sure did. I mean, some of these hotspots are actually in the favelas. The hotspots are the places where people can go and make music, record music, or make film. And then, you know, they've got everything there.
Gil is one of Brazil's most famous musicians and has been for decades. Let's listen to one of his older songs to get a sense of what he's about. What would you recommend?
An old favorite of mine from 1979 called Toda Menina Baiana. Toda menina baiana tem santo que Deus dá. Toda menina baiana tem encanto que Deus dá. Toda menina baiana tem jeito que Deus dá. Toda menina baiana tem defeito também que Deus dá.
So Tendai, what am I hearing in that music that is distinctly Brazilian?
The language, for starters.
Yes, the language. Do you know what it is he's saying in English?
I did ask a Portuguese person here, and they told me that it's a tribute to all women. And all women are beautiful.
Oh, to all basically. Women. That's very good of him.
Basically, that's what you say it is. It might also like have something to do with women from his region, the region that he comes from, which is Bahia. She said to me, well, it's a tribute to all women. All women are beautiful.
Okay, so it's a tribute to women. And what about the rhythm or the instruments being used here?
The way he comes in with the guitar and also the percussion, it's a kind of a mid-tempo samba. There's an element of samba there. So that's how you would place it as Brazilian music.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to his new album and look at some of the ways he's pushing the boundaries of what he's done before. What song do you recommend?
There's a song here called Os País, and I really like this song.
Nas mãos dos narcomarginais, ou então nas
I like this song a lot because it's a fusion of Brazilian music and reggae. Gil was a champion of reggae music that became big when Bob Marley was making waves. And he was a major champion of this music. Da moça que expressa no andar provocante a força ondulante da sua moral, amor flutuante acima do bem e do mal.
Now, I understand he was really eager to leave politics and go back to music. I mean, it was a strange transition to go from a famous musician to politics, but he wanted out, and the president tried to encourage him to stay for a while, and he left anyway.
Twice he tried to resign from the ministry, as you rightly said, and President Lula only accepted his resignation on the third time. I think everybody who loves music all over the world really welcomes Gil back with both arms.
Tendai, why don't we go out on one of his popular songs from the new album?
I would suggest a song called La Renaissance Africaine. This is about the hope of a rebirth of Africa after all the tribulations that this continent has been through.
Listen to that, and I'll say so long to you. Thanks again so much for being our music expert today.
Thanks a lot, Peggy. It was a pleasure as always. L'homme est son paysage aimé, tout est là devant ses yeux, tout est dans les baobabs. La Renaissance africaine, la Renaissance africaine, et sa puissance. La Renaissance.
Tendai Maposa is our guide to global music. He spoke to us from Harare, Zimbabwe. C'est l'Afrique liberté, c'est l'Afrique ses idées, de sagesse, de vigueur. C'est l'Afrique sa mission, clé pour la reconstruction du monde civil. Mexico is the birthplace of chocolate. The story goes that a Mayan god presented his people with a gift from the Garden of Paradise, the cacao tree from which chocolate is made. Nowhere in Mexico is chocolate held in higher esteem than in Oaxaca. It's said that every man, woman, and child in this city consumes chocolate at least once a day. Reporter Mary Stuckey turned to Pilar Cabrera, a well-known Mexican chef, to learn the secret of making chocolate atole. That's a special kind of Mexican hot chocolate. We join them on Minna Street, where the air is rich with the smell of chocolate.
We're at Chocolate Mayordomo, one of the very first chocolate stores to open in Oaxaca. We're buying the raw ingredients for chocolate atole, perhaps the most popular form of hot chocolate in Mexico.
And here we stop in the first place and start the business of chocolate in Oaxaca, Chocolate Mayordomo. Here we have in front of us have cacao, cinnamon, almonds, and sugar. I prefer more proportion of almonds and less sugar. This is the flavor I learned from my grandmom. Me puedes vender media molienda de este.
Okay, so she is putting these cacao beans, oh, like big coffee beans, really, on an old-fashioned scale and weighing them in a big metal dish. After we buy the ingredients, we cross the street to where the grinders are. About half a dozen work in one huge shop whose doors are open to the busy street. Ancient grinding machines pulverize the cacao beans, almonds, sugar, and cinnamon. And then men mix the ingredients into a paste by hand using a knife. Now, even though we have the chocolate paste flavored with almond, cinnamon, and sugar, we're not going to make our own chocolate atole today. Instead, we'll take a short taxi ride to the market to join in a morning ritual in Oaxaca. This market is right next door to the school Pilar attended as a child.
We come into the market almost every day. Yeah, and for me, my best place is Comedor Mari. They prepare the best chocolate we have here in the city. We call chocolate atole. Doña Mari, venimos a visitarla.
Pilar greets the proprietor, Maria Ramirez Vasquez. The 70-year-old, wearing an apron and long braids, stands in front of a huge pot. Inside, dried corn is boiling in water. This is the corn atole, the base ingredient in the hot chocolate drink.
People cook the corn, dry corn, one day in advance. And this water, thick atole, because boiling and boiling, and at the end combined with the chocolate, without almonds, and a lot of cinnamon.
But there's a special way in which the thick corn and the chocolate are combined.
And use the molinillo to bring foamy on the top of the chocolate.
The molinillo is a foot-long wooden whisk. It's a lot of work to use it. There's no milk in this drink, but even without it, Maria whips up a substantial foam. The foam is said to contain the energy of the person who made the drink. That person must be a woman, whose worth as a cook is determined by how much foam she can create. Maria tells Pilar she makes 30 liters of chocolate atole every day to sell in the market. That's a lot of whisking.
At the end, serve in a big bowl with a wooden spoon. We stir the mixture, and then we drink it. And I feel the delicious flavor of the chocolate, and the combination with the corn atole is great. Do you want to try it?
Nothing like our hot chocolate. It's completely different. This isn't so sweet.
Yeah.
And no milk in this.
No milk. Doña Mari. Nos vemos.
Time to go. Chocolate atole is a breakfast drink, and the morning is passing. As we leave, we spot two schoolgirls, heads bent over huge bowls of Doña Maria's hot chocolate.
Bebe chocolate cada día?
Sí.
The girls say they start each day with a bowl of chocolate atole, just like countless generations before them. For the World Vision Report, I'm Mary Stuckey in Oaxaca, Mexico.
Chocolate's been going up in price, just like many other foods, and consumers around the world are feeling the pinch. That includes people in Canada, where staples like bread, pasta, and flour have all gone up. Food inflation is expected to continue, but that might not deter some of Montreal's citizens from visiting the upscale Robin des Bois restaurant. That's French for Robin Hood. Customers at the upscale restaurant know the money they're spending on dinner is helping the poor at the same time. Here's reporter Judith Ritter from Montreal.
Robin des Bois, bonsoir.
It's not easy to get a reservation at Montreal's hot new eatery, Robin des Bois. Tonight, this sleek bistro's packed. Even big-name actors and directors are on a waiting list. Not just to dine, but to work so that money saved on wages can be donated to the poor.
Tonight is my first night.
A little scared?
Yeah, I'm scared.
Catherine Pilon usually directs music videos for Quebec's version of MTV. Clearly, she's more comfortable giving orders than taking them.
I'd like to know what you put in your boudin créole. Good question. For me, it's my first time. Oh, my God.
I'll be right back.
She hasn't a clue. But the diners celebrating a birthday are unfazed. They know the servers are volunteers, and they know the profits go to local charities. They've also heard that a server spilling a glass of water might even be a local media heartthrob.
Patrice Cocro was here. He was he's one of the most famous actors in Quebec. And he was here, just serving on the tables. And obviously, people was just actually freaking out.
That's TV personality Philippe Femieux. His wife, Judy Servais, is the mastermind behind the Robin Hood restaurant. The idea caught on with their glittery acquaintances, and now there's a waiting list of 1,400 doctors, artists, and actors all ready to wait tables, wash dishes, and chop vegetables for free. The chefs get paid, but not what they're used to. But for Chef Sebastian Corville, that's just fine.
It touched me every day because they give to the community. I really love it.
And while other restaurants struggle for financing, not this place, a local bank gave, yes, gave them $25,000 to start up. And after just 4 months, Robin Dubois in the black. So soon, the hotspot will turn over its first profits to a homeless shelter, a project for street kids, and a food bank. In the meantime, show business folks are working hard to master a new profession.
Okay, one boudin créole. And something to drink?
Over at the birthday table, the music video director turned server is getting a little smoother.
I'll be better maybe by the third table. What do you think?
Good luck, Catherine. Just don't quit your day job. For the World Vision Report, I'm Judith Ritter in Montreal.
Bonne fête, Hélène. Bonne fête, Hélène.
Bonne fête, Hélène.
Et puis, pépère.
Rien qu'un petit bout d'ongle dans un coin de ma poche de ce que tu rongeais quand je te faisais des reproches.
Coming up, we hear the story of one extraordinary midwife in Mali. We speak with author Chris Holloway about her book Monique and the Mango Range. We'll be back with that after a short break. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. For the rest of the hour, we take you to Mali in West Africa. The country has one of the highest maternal death rates in the world. A woman there has a 1 in 12 chance of dying during pregnancy and childbirth. In America, it's 1 in 3,000. So in Mali, a village midwife is honored and overworked. Monique Dembélé was one of them. A young woman of 24, Monique delivered hundreds of babies without electricity, water, or emergency backup. Author Chris Holloway saw this all firsthand when she was in Mali as a Peace Corps volunteer. In her book, Monique and the Mango Rains, she describes the life of this remarkable woman, the only person in her village who earned a government salary.
It was absolutely unique. There was no other woman in the village that had sort of an official role. So not only was she the midwife, but she was also the only healthcare worker, meaning all the villagers would come to her if they had cuts or wounds, if they had malaria, if they needed aspirin, and she would treat them.
And how old was she?
24.
She was 24. How much training did she have in delivering babies?
She had 9 months of medical training and also had 2 years of apprenticeship with the older women in the village who were the traditional midwives. And she had a sixth grade education in school.
Wow.
So as you can imagine, you know, when we think of people delivering babies here, they're very educated with all these, you know, letters after their names and certifications. And here she was doing the work with so little and was truly gifted in what she was doing.
What kind of medicine and equipment did she have for that kind of medical treatment?
Oh, geez, you know, very rudimentary, and she was always running out of supplies. Supplies were in short demand, so she would have an array of shots that she could give that had antibiotics in them or vitamins. At that time, she did not have IVs, though they do have IVs there now in Nampusala, and she'd have a variety of pills, especially against malaria. So very rudimentary. There's no electricity, so she was not able to store anything that would need to be kept cool. She had a blood pressure cuff, you know, and basic sutures and scissors.
You shadowed Monique in the village for 2 years, and I was struck by the fact that you wrote that when you would wake up early in the morning, Monique was already hard at work. You could hear her rustling in the other room. What was her typical day like?
It was a combination of sort of a traditional rural woman's role and a woman who's in charge of the village for the first time role. So she had to straddle both of those worlds, meaning she worked all the time, you know, 18, 20-hour days. So not only was she on call if there were any births in a, you know, village of 1,400 people where women give birth 6 to 7 times in their lives, but she also was on call if there was an accident. And then she was in charge of cooking all the meals in the family. And cooking the meals, Peggy, is a lot of work there because there's no, you know, there's no mill to grind the millet, so you have to pound it by hand. There's no dishwashers. There's no running water, so she's got to get the water at the well. There's all these steps that go into simply preparing food that take an immense amount of time.
And taking care of her small children.
Right, and she had, you know, her little baby boy, Basile, on her back, or nursing. And certainly as he got into walking stage, sort of toddling around her, and she was running after him. So the amount of work was staggering, really staggering.
So you talk about this incredibly long and difficult day. I have to ask you, what was her attitude like?
She was absolutely cheerful and joyful. I think she was so thankful that she didn't have to work in the fields. She didn't question whether she should be working that hard because every woman she'd ever known in her life did. But she got to do work that she knew was helping people. And that gave her the courage to meet every day. She totally adored her work.
Mm. Now, you mentioned that all the other women had to work in the field. Monique had the only job that paid a salary. How did the other women in the village feel about her? Did they respect her? Did they envy her?
I think the other women at first questioned, who is this young woman who has such power? Who is this young woman who thinks she can help us give birth? And at first, as I understand it, it was hard. When I got there, she'd been doing the work for 2 or 3 years. So As the Dugutigi and Monique said, it took the Dugutigi being the village chief that I asked these questions to, and Monique said it took a while for them to accept her, but then they saw how skilled she was, and they saw how much she deeply cared for their health and their babies. And her reputation grew as women gave birth and said, oh my gosh, Monique is just awesome. She, you know, my baby was really big, but she helped me deliver it, or she stopped in and checked on to see how I was doing. So as they saw the type of person that she was, they let go of all those questions. And I think no one envied her because they couldn't imagine doing the job that she did.
Mm-hmm. Now, Chris, you wrote this book on Monique because you two became fast friends almost immediately when you arrived there and met her. What do you think it was, or what was it that bonded the two of you so quickly?
I get asked that a bit, and I'm always trying to figure out what that was. And I think there's something about friendship that, at the risk of sounding corny, is magical. You don't know why your best friends are your friends, but I bet, Peggy, you can think of some of the women that are your dear friends, and there's just a connection you feel. And I think it was also that she was an outsider like I was. She didn't quite fit the mold of a typical woman in Namposala, in my village. And so she married into this village of Namposala, like all women in rural Mali, when they marry, go to their husband's villages. So it wasn't her natal village. And she was the only woman to have any kind of formal education, even though she had left in the 6th grade. So she was the only woman who could read and write. And so I think she had access to ideas and thoughts and abilities that she was not able to share with anybody else.
You write in your book that you became Monique's confidant. How did you feel that you could help Monique?
I felt like she could share with me her ideas and the things that might be a little controversial, because there was nothing to lose. I didn't have a position of power. I wasn't going to go and tell the village leaders what she wanted. And so she had so many ideas, such as repairing the birthing house because it was falling apart and couldn't be used in the rain, such as receiving her salary because it went to her father-in-law rather than herself, so I could just be a conduit so that she could manifest her ideas.
And were you able to help her do that?
I was able to really facilitate some of the changes she wanted. And, you know, sometimes I had to push a little harder, like for her getting her salary. She was like, oh, yeah, I want my salary. But, oh, geez, Fatimata, which was my name there. You know, gosh, let's not really talk about that. And so I sometimes I had to push a little bit because it was something I really felt strongly about. And other times I would sort of follow her lead. And in terms of a confidant, she really wanted to see her first love, who she would have married had she not been given in marriage to her husband. And so I was able to make sure they got to see each other. And she could do that because my presence sort of made it culturally acceptable.
Yeah, that's interesting. And you talk about her marriage. It wasn't a very good marriage. How did her husband treat her?
No, it wasn't. With indifference and disrespect. I think it would have been hard for any man in Mali to be married to Monique because she was just this firecracker, charismatic woman. And in Mali, at least in rural Mali, I should say, the man is really in charge of the woman and the children. They sort of are owned by him. And so a man in Mali would have had to have been pretty spectacular to tolerate all the attention that his wife was getting. And Monique outstripped her husband Francois in almost every way. And as she worked and her reputation grew and it was clear the gifts that she had, the level that she achieved and the level that her husband was achieving, that sort of abyss between them only got greater and greater until it was unbridgeable.
Chris, you were there in Mali with Monique for 2 years. And when you returned to the States, you stayed in close touch with her. Both of you sent packages back and forth and you wrote. And I understand she even came to visit you in the United States.
I knew I didn't want to leave Monique and the village without knowing she could come and visit me in my village. It just felt so important that the people in my hometown of Granville, Ohio, got to meet her, and she came. And she saw New York City, Washington, D.C., and then Central Ohio, which is really all you need to see in the States, right? But I wanted her to have a lot of time just in my hometown, so it wasn't a whirlwind tour. So I think New York and D.C. were wonderful and overwhelming. And she loved being here. She loved relaxing. She got even funnier than she was in Mali. She had this unbelievable sense of humor and was always telling jokes here. And because it was her only vacation in her adult life, and sure, she was blown away by, you know, the skyscrapers in New York and the National Cathedral in D.C. since she was a devout Catholic, but she mostly was shocked by the dishwasher, the washing machine, the fact that we had multiple sources of clean, potable water in our homes. And I think the things that she found disconcerting were that no one was outside. We're not walking around, we're not hanging out outside, and she missed being able to walk around my parents' neighborhood and greet people.
Chris, after Monique went back, she wrote you that she was pregnant with her fourth child, and she wanted you to help her figure out how to find birth control for the future because she didn't want more children. And then many months later, you waited to hear about the new baby, and you received a letter from her cousin. What did it say?
Well, her cousin, who's her eldest brother in her terms, had written me saying that, unfortunately, Monique had died in childbirth. So at that point, my world sort of cracked open. Here I was expecting the the wonderful news that Monique had given birth. And so that's when John and I, my husband, who I met in the Peace Corps and the editor of the book, decided to go back to Mali, because I had to figure out how in the world does this midwife, this fantastic midwife herself, die in childbirth.
How does that happen? I mean, here she had been the one woman in the village to deliver all these babies, so many of them safely, and then she herself dies in childbirth. What happened? What went wrong?
Well, she succumbed to what 1 in 12 women succumb to, and there's a medical level and there's a human rights level. And the medical level is that she probably had hypertension, and also was probably anemic due to repeated attacks of malaria, and then was given a shot of ergometrin, which is like a Pitocin, to augment her labor. And those shots are only supposed to be used to control postpartum bleeding, but they're used in Mali to get the labor going when people feel there's no recourse because there are no IV drips as we use here. That caused her, given her hypertensive state, to either have a stroke or a heart attack. But the deeper level is one of a lack of human rights, as I see it, in that she was pregnant and she did not want to be. She did not have control over her own fertility. And also lack of health and nutrition. She was not able to get healthy foods because she and her husband had been arguing, and he had this big garden full of fresh vegetables and fruits that she did not have access to. And also he wanted her to give birth alone and refused to transport her into the next town over, this bigger town where she could give birth with midwives, so she had to hitch a ride to give birth. So there are these layers of her just not having control over the decisions that affect her life and her body, and then the lack of medical care.
I'm wondering if Monique has some kind of legacy in the village, a tangible legacy you could see. Is anything different as a result of her life and maybe even her death?
Absolutely. I think John and I, when we went back this past December, were shocked at just how strong her legacy is. Her legacy in Mali through in Namposala, in the village, is that there's a raised awareness around health for women. The clinic that now Henri Traore is running, he took over when we were there and worked with Monique until she died.
And who is he?
Henri Traore is the village health worker that we helped train when we were in Mali so that Monique wouldn't have to do all the work. And so the clinic has grown. The birthing house is still being used. And as I looked over the birthing records for the past year, there were no mothers lost. They have seen how important it is that women are transferred early. And now with cell phones having come to Mali, which was the biggest change we saw, they, as soon as they sense that something's going to go wrong, they're on the cell phone, they try to get a car. There's now one car owned by someone in Namposala, and they evacuate her. So the legacy in Namposala is clear. And I have to say, if I can continue with that legacy, her legacy within her own family is that her sister, Angèle, has become a midwife paid through donations here in the States, continuing Monique's work and working in an AIDS orphanage. Her brother is now a healthcare worker in a neighboring village. His name is Abel. And her cousin, her elder brother, if you will, Maxime, has started Clinique Monique in a nearby village called Kouri, which he established in 2004 in her honor and which we're helping to fund. So we've raised, through book royalties and private donations, over $25,000 for medical supplies, for his training, and for the clinic. And that is a direct legacy that she's had. And her kids are all three of them still in school with dreams of teaching and working in healthcare.
All right. Chris Holloway, thanks so much for joining us and telling us about Monique.
Thank you.
That was Chris Holloway talking about her book, Monique and the Mango Rains. And we have a reading from the book on our website. If you'd like to hear it, go to worldvisionreport.org.
There's lots to do there. You can download a podcast of the show, and you can read blogs from our reporters around the world. We'd love to hear from you. Join the conversation at worldvisionreport.org. The program is produced by Beverly Abel and edited by Diane Toomey. Lita Hartman is the assignments editor. Cynthia Graber produced the interviews. Doug Boyles and Mark Bandy are our audio engineers. I'm Peggy Waymire. Thanks for listening.
This program is produced with funding from World Vision. The views expressed in this show are not necessarily those of the organization.
Mara mafenya kisila juguma, tura inye mara fenye.